Welcome to the Humorist Union of Madison monthly meeting. And we're very pleased to have Robin Proud as our speaker today, speaking about Ernestine Rose. Robin?
I have a couple of quotations first from Ernestine Rose from 1870. There's almost a settled fact that woman is a human being, that she has a mind, and that that mind requires cultivation, that she has wants and needs. Remember that woman's rights simply means human rights. Now, I was struck by that one because Hillary Clinton basically said the same thing 10 years ago or so. And then there's another quote from her. What has man ever done that woman under the same advantages could not do? Will you tell us that women have no Newtons, Shakespeare's, and Byrons? Greater natural powers than even these possessed may have been destroyed in woman for want of proper culture, a just appreciation, reward for merit as an incentive to exertion, and freedom of action, without which mind becomes cramped and stifled, for it cannot expand under bolts and bars. And this was 78 years before Virginia Woolf, in a room of one's own, talked about Shakespeare's sister and what life would have been like that would have made it impossible for Shakespeare's sister to become famous. So did anyone here ever hear of this person before this? And I wouldn't even bother asking that of 99.99% of the world's population.
What was your name again?
Yeah. And I think at Sauk City there was one person who, there's a woman there who was an American Studies major who did a lot of work on the women's movement. So I came across her in Freethinkers, A History of American Secularism by Susan Jacoby, which some of you must know that book. I got it at Half Price Books or Frugal Muse, and I recommend it. And I also have a book called Women Without Superstition, No Gods, No Masters, published by the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which I also picked up at one of those secondhand stores. That was edited by Annie Laurie Gaylor. So they've got a little section on her. But it was in the Freethinkers book that I first saw the name, and I thought, how could it be this name has never even come up in a different research I've done about some of these historical women? Because when you start looking into it, she was right in there with them. She wouldn't have come up on any list of Unitarian or Universalist women because she was neither. She was born into a Jewish family. She gave up religion by the age of 14 and unabashedly proclaimed herself an atheist for the rest of her life. She devoted her life to speaking and working for freedom on the three fronts that she felt were interrelated. What is that? We call that now intersectionality? What is that? Abolition of slavery, women's rights, and freedom from religion. Now, it's probably because of her atheism and her position as an immigrant that she's disappeared from most accounts of the fight for women's suffrage in America. So after I looked into this, and then I asked Bob, and he had to go to Wikipedia like I did to find out about her. I thought, oh, Bob will know about her. So there is a book, and because I was kind of rushed today, I didn't bring over this book, but there is one book written in 2017 by Professor Bonnie Anderson. It's not terribly long. It's very readable. And it's called The Rabbi's Atheist Daughter, Ernestine Rose, International Feminist Pioneer. So I got it from Amazon, I think, but I'm sure one of the other bookstores would order it for you. She lived from 1810, which was also the birth year of Margaret Fuller, to 1892. She was at her peak in the 1850s. Observers at the time constantly praised her speeches for their logical and clear arguments and her exceptional speaking skill, even though English was at least her third language. In the newspaper, the Albany Transcript, they wrote, "She is the queen of the company of women's rights speakers, and she has as great a power to chain an audience as any of our male speakers." Susan B. Anthony wrote, "They who sat with her on the platform will remember her matchless powers as a speaker. She had a rich musical voice and a ready flow of choice language. In style, she was clear, logical, and impassioned." She was born Ernestine Potowski. She was the only child of a rabbi and his wife in Poland. Now, like Margaret Fuller and many of the other women I've spoken about, she was educated by her father with the curriculum he would have provided for a boy, since he had no sons. So in this case, she learned Hebrew and studied the Torah. She used her intelligence to challenge her father's insistence on traditions like fasting and refraining from work on the Sabbath. At 12, she decided to test God by breaking a piece of straw on the Sabbath, which her father insisted qualified as work. She asked God to send her a sign if she was disobeying him. When nothing happened, she broke not only the straw, but her tie to God. At 14, she officially renounced all belief in God and the Bible. Of course, this introduced a serious rift with her father. When she was 15, the rabbi engaged her to a man he had chosen, and this was normal to get married around age 16, and the girls had no say in who they married, just like Fiddler on the Roof, maybe. Ernestine refused to marry a man she didn't love, and a man who would not treat her as an equal. And her mother had passed away recently, leaving her an inheritance. Well, this would have passed to her husband. She refused to cede that inheritance. She begged this man to release her, but he refused, and he pointed out that if she broke the engagement, according to the laws or traditions, he was entitled to keep a large part of her inheritance. He brought a lawsuit against her to possess her property. At the age of 17, she decided to travel 65 miles to the capital to plead her own case. It was winter. She hired a sleigh with just a driver. When it broke down, she sent the driver for help, even though it was night. She waited alone, as she later wrote, wrapped in furs from 11:30 at night until 4 in the morning on an immense plain of snow, listening to the howls of packs of starving wolves. So she had a lot of courage. She won her case, which formed the base of her drive to constantly speak up and, as she said, agitate. However, apparently she was away for some time in the capital. During that time, her father took a new wife, the same age as Ernestine. She said only that she could not harmonize with her new stepmother. She left Poland for Berlin, which was known as a cosmopolitan and liberal city. But even so, Jews wishing to enter the city had to have a German citizen post bonds for them, or they had to get royal permission to stay. Ernestine refused to ask for bonds, and she went straight to the king. King Friedrich Wilhelm II was taken with her and offered to have her baptized with himself as godfather. This would take care of the problem. She would no longer be a Jew. Ernestine replied, "I thank you, Your Majesty, but I have not abandoned the trunk in order to attach myself to the branches. If my reason prevents me from being Jewish, it cannot permit me to be Christian." The king, nevertheless, gave her permission to stay as long as she liked, which turned out to be 2 years. To support herself, she created a business, a paper to perfume apartments. Many people lived in rented rooms, and so one account called these the first odor eaters. After that, she traveled to France and the Netherlands, and in 1831, at the age of 21, she arrived in England. Here she met Robert Owen. Now, that's maybe somebody that some of you are familiar with. He was a great influence. He was an industrialist who refused the common practices of child labor and subjugation of workers. His innovations in schools and workers' benefits reaped great success, and he wanted to extend these policies to the country as a whole. He planned to establish agricultural and manufacturing communes run by qualified leaders. He also denounced the Christian principle of original sin. He saw evil as the result of structural societal organization rather than of personal morality. And this is a discussion people have today, right? Is it that people are have bad morals when they're living in poverty? He rejected religion, marriage, and private property. Ernestine was an enthusiastic supporter. She later said of him, "It has been said that he was a fanatic. Whoever did anything good without being a fanatic? It is said that he did not succeed. But where he did not succeed in the past, he will in the future. He shook the foundation of the old system." Among other views, the Owenists saw women as equal to men, and they encouraged women to speak in public, which was still a scandalous idea in England and America at that time. Female speakers were routinely stigmatized as witches, she-devils, and whores. A standard tactic was for men to come to the woman's lecture and shout out Bible verses mandating women's silence in order to drown her out. New England ministers issued a public letter declaring that such actions would cause, speaking in public would cause women to cease to bear fruit. That is, they would become sterile if they got up and spoke in public, and they would fall in shame and dishonor into the dust. Of course, such prejudices died long ago, right? Well, when I did this talk, which was sometime in the last year, right before that, there was a Southern Baptist convention in Alabama, and there was a controversy about whether a woman could speak to the whole gathering. And a Christian theology professor said, "One thing we have massive agreement on, women do not preach on Sunday to the church. Doing so is functional egalitarianism." That was obviously a bad thing. So we haven't all evolved so much. In England, Ernestine met another Owenite named William Rose. When they married, it was not in any church, but by saying simple vows in front of a notary. Shortly after they left for New York, they knew there were communities of Owenites in the New World. Within a few months, Ernestine joined a campaign in New York to give married women rights to their own property. She went door to door in Manhattan with a petition supporting the reform. She wrote about her experience. "After a good deal of trouble, I obtained 5 signatures. Some of the ladies said the gentlemen would laugh at them. Others said they had rights enough. And the men said the women had too many rights already." But Ernestine was always proud of her involvement with this very early initiative of the women's rights movement. This was 1836, and the Seneca Falls Convention was not to occur for another 12 years. In 1848, New York was actually the first state to pass a law giving women property rights. Just as now, atheism was an even bigger taboo than feminism. Atheists were called infidels. The Owenite communes were condemned as havens for free love. Since they didn't believe in marriage as such, everyone assumed there must be all kinds of things going on. In truth, just like most of the 19th century communes, these groups never lasted long because of conflicts over how strict to be in their eating, their naivete about forming a society, and sometimes indeed because of romantic or sexual affairs. The Owenites chose to claim the word infidel, the same way some groups claimed the word queer more recently. In 1845, the Infidel Convention opened in New York City, with 500 freethinkers attending. Robert Owen, 74 years old, opened the convention, and Ernestine Rose spoke next. She condemned both religion and capitalism. She said that what those two meant was everyone for himself and some supernatural power for us all. She said that had left the world in a sorry state. She had special concerns for women. She had already said in 1844, "What rights have women? Are they not the merest slaves on earth? In government they are not known, but to be punished for breaking laws in which they have no voice in the making. All avenues to enterprise and honor are closed against them. If poor, they must drudge for a mere pittance. If of the wealthy classes, they must be dressed dolls of fashion, parlor puppets, female things. My sisters, speak for yourselves. Tyrants never will willingly relinquish their grasp." When the women's suffrage movement arose in the 1850s, it was their dedication to the cause that compelled women like Stanton and Anthony to go on hazardous and uncomfortable speaking tours. Neither of them really had spent time speaking before, but Ernestine Rose had been a traveling speaker for years already. Many activists of the time felt they needed to choose one cause, abolition, women's rights, or free thought. But Ernestine always linked them together. As support for abolition and women's rights grew, tolerance of atheism diminished. The Enlightenment generation of Thomas Paine was being replaced by an atmosphere of Christian revivalism and Victorian morality. And many people did, in a positive vein, connect their Christian religious beliefs with abolition, for instance. But Rose never backed down or tempered her convictions. She also never took payment for her speeches, and she did all her own cleaning, cooking, and housework so that the money she would have spent on a servant could be used to support her travel expenses and the rental of halls. Her husband was totally supportive. His business as a jeweler and silversmith enabled Ernestine to devote herself to her calling. Ernestine had 2 children, both of whom died in infancy. She never wrote or spoke publicly about them or other aspects of her private life. She was constantly praised for her speaking ability. In 1860, a female reporter at the National Women's Rights Convention found a number of the speakers dull. Then she wrote, "I was infinitely relieved when Mrs. Ernestine L. Rose took the floor. A good delivery, a forcible voice, the most uncommon good sense, a delightful terseness of style, and a rare talent for humor are the qualifications which so well fit this lady for a public speaker. In about 2 minutes, she managed to infect her 2,000-fold audience with a spirit of interest, an audience which mere dry morals and reason had succeeded in reducing to a comatose state. So he woke them up. Rose said, "The ballot is the focus of all other rights. It is the pivot upon which all others hang. We're sensitive to the same issue today. If voters are denied access, our government is no longer representational, and other reforms are delayed." And let's see, Wikipedia tells us that, Rose was elected president of the National Women's Rights Convention in October 1854, in spite of objections that she was an atheist. Her election was heavily supported by Susan B. Anthony, who declared that every religion or none should have an equal right on the platform. Although she never seemed to attach great importance to her Jewish background, in 1863, Ernestine Rose had a published debate with Horace Seaver, the abolitionist editor of the Boston Investigator, whom she accused of being anti-Semitic. Letters to the editor condemning her took a tone with which we are all too familiar today. So she was refuting what he had said. She was denounced for scolding like a termagant, writing spleeny inanities, and being personal, abusive, and ill-natured. That is, she was a nasty woman, we would say today, or some would say. In 1858, Rose was the keynote speaker at a radical free convention in Rutland, Vermont. They invited friends of human progress from all groups, abolitionists, women's rights workers, freethinkers, also spiritualists, proponents of free love, and others. Ernestine was the only immigrant and the only female atheist. Outsiders denounced this gathering as a convention of moral lunatics. Ernestine sometimes debated religion with ministers. From her training, she knew the Bible well. She pointed out, as Jimmy Carter has recently, how the Bible was often used to oppress and silence women. She called the God of the creation a bad father for his treatment of Adam and Eve. And there are some examples of this. In 1861, she gave a lecture called A Defense of Atheism, which she stood by the rest of her life as defining her view. She first reviewed all the branches of science to show that no proof of God could be found in any of them. Then she began to analyze the Bible. She showed that the Garden of Eden story was impossible for an omnipotent, omniscient, loving God. The serpent tempted Mother Eve, and she, like a good wife, tempted her husband. But did God not know when he created the serpent that it would tempt the woman, and that she was made out of such frail materials, the rib of Adam, as to not be able to resist the temptation? If he did not know, then his knowledge was at fault. If he did but could not prevent that calamity, then his power was at fault. If he knew and could but would not, then his goodness was at fault. So there is no way he could be omnipotent, omniscient, and loving. Choose which you please, and it remains fatal to the rest. Then man, who was supposedly made perfectly in God's image, became even more wicked, so that God decided to send the flood as punishment. Rose said, "So he destroyed everything, except Noah with his family and a few household pets." I love this woman. I would love to meet her. Why he saved them is hard to say, unless it was to reserve materials as stock in hand to commence a new world. But really, judging of the character of those he saved by their descendants, it strikes me it would have been much better and given him far less trouble to have let them slip also, and with his improved experience, made a new world out of fresh and superior materials. That is, Noah's descendants were not any better, right? From what we read in the Bible, he could have started over with man 2.0.
Start fresh.
She said, the world was not one jot better after the flood, and he was forced to resort to the last sad alternative of sending, quote, his only begotten son, his second self, to save them. Did he succeed even then? Is the world saved from ignorance? It is all around us. From poverty, vice, crime, sin, misery, and shame, it abounds everywhere. And she listed slavery, war, cruelty, and natural disasters. Why does God still permit these horrors to afflict the race? Would infinite wisdom, power, and goodness allow his children thus to live, to suffer, and to die? She concludes by answering a question that still dogs humanists, agnostics, and atheists today. How can someone be moral without a fear of God? She said, "If I have no faith in your religion, I have faith unbounded, unshaken faith in the principles of right, of justice, and humanity. Whatever good you are willing to do for the sake of your God, I am full as willing to do for the sake of man." She goes on to say that atheists actually behave better than believers since they never persecute or kill others in the name of religion. She concludes, "Whatever good you would do out of fear of punishment or hope of reward hereafter, the atheist would do simply because it is good. And being so, he would receive the far surer and more certain reward springing from well-doing, which would constitute his pleasure and promote his happiness." That is, the atheist gets an immediate reward of knowing that he or she has done a good thing and sees how it is impacting the world, as opposed to waiting many years until you die and seeing whether you had earned a good ending. If non-believers were excoriated as infidels, how much worse was a woman proclaiming such views? At one of Rose's talks, students from a nearby theological seminary yelled at her to go home and extinguish the gas lighting. In 1835, a Bangor clergyman, horrified that Rose was scheduled to speak in his town, wrote, "We know of no object more deserving of contempt, loathing, and abhorrence than a female atheist. We hold the vilest strumpet from the stews to be by comparison respectable." This criticism had the effect of publicizing the speech, which drew a sympathetic audience. The same thing happened in 1860 on Long Island. A minister directed the women of his congregation not to attend Rose's lecture. She wrote, "Had the minister simply refused to read the notice, that is, announce it, I don't think I would have had any audience at all. As it was, I thought, as he opened the ball, I will let him dance to his own tune. I have been requested to speak again as soon as they can make arrangements." So lots of people came and they wanted her to come back again. She said they had never heard a woman nor an infidel speaker before. You may be aware that after the Civil War, the women's suffrage movement split over whether to prioritize the voting rights of new black citizens, men, or to first champion votes for women. One argument was that voting rights for freed slaves in the South was literally a matter of life and death, so that should be first. Susan B. Anthony, we think today, unfortunately, chose to ally herself with racist donors and to use fears of uneducated blacks and immigrants to insist on the white women's need to vote to protect society. She used that as a way to get backing for women's rights in the South. Oh, have your white women vote. Of course, Ernestine Rose always insisted on both reforms, but she was already gone from the main U.S. movement. In the second half of her life, Rose dealt with various health issues. She traveled to European spas in 1858. Except for one visit to the U.S., she and her husband remained abroad for the rest of their lives. No one really knows why, although she seemed to think it was better for her health. So this absence from the American scene could be another reason for her anonymity, as she left when the movement was heating up. Another reason so little is known is that she herself kept no diaries. Susan B. Anthony was writing her history of woman suffrage and asked Rose for information, and she wrote back, "I have nothing to refer to. I have never spoken from notes," which is impressive, "and as I do not intend to publish anything about myself, for I had no ambition except to work for the cause of humanity, irrespective of sex, sect, country, or color, and I did not expect that a Susan B. Anthony would wish to do it for me," that is, I didn't think Susan B. Anthony would be writing about me, "I made no memorandum or, you know, diary of places, dates, or names, and 30 or 40 years ago, the press was not sufficiently educated in the rights of women even to notice, much less to report speeches as it does now. And therefore, I have not anything to assist me or you." So, and she doesn't seem to have written many letters, or at least they were not preserved in the same way that other women of the time now have those available to us. The death of Ernestine's husband, William, in 1882 from a heart attack devastated her. She became more and more isolated until her own death 10 years later. In 1871, the Boston Investigator predicted that Ernestine would be appreciated in about 100 years. This turned out to be true, as she was rediscovered through the women's liberation and Jewish studies movements starting in the 1970s. So for someone who was so well known at the time, so appreciated as a speaker, and such a unique individual, it's just surprising that she's been so unknown and not studied. And the last quote that I had, she said, "Emancipation from every kind of bondage is my principle."
have a question. I must have missed how she met this husband.
In England, when she was a sort of disciple of Robert Owen, he was also. So they both believed in this new kind of community without the traditional marriage and without religion, and with society being useful for all people.
But they got married anyway?
They did get married at a notary's. I think that was more a practical, but I think that was more a practical thing. That's kind of like William Godwin, Mary Shelley's father, who was famously against marriage, but did get legally married because it was just so much easier for children and for property and things like that.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
The statement was something to the effect that there's nothing worse than a female atheist. Does that mean a male atheist is slightly higher on that?
Apparently
so.
Why
do they need to put that qualifier on that?
Yeah, no, apparently it was even worse that a woman...
Because a woman's not supposed to think.
Well,
herself.
A woman shouldn't think,
what
and she shouldn't get up
remark.
And shouldn't get up and speak. Yeah, yeah, that... Yeah, male atheists were pretty low, but somehow this was even...
But a man could be excused.
But that's exactly the same... What is that? Reminds me of something here. But, Anyway, it's not a coincidence that the people attacked by our president are women, sometimes women of color or women who stand up to disagree more than, I think, in general, more and in more... I don't know, more personal terms, I don't know. But anyway.
I have to share a story from when I was a high school English teacher and we were studying Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, and I was talking about the woman of Bath and how she would be like today's feminist. That would be in the 60s that I was doing this. And after class, one of my male students came up to me and he said, "You don't really believe that, do you? That women are just as good as men." He just wanted to be, he was one of my dumber boy students. So he wanted to know that he would be above any female, no matter what.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's still out there.
Yes. Don't say anything you don't want people to hear.
Well, in 1972, when I was in grad school, one of the guys, he was in some scientific field, but he said, "Oh, no, I want a wife that will, stay at home and keep house for me and have dinner ready and so on." And when I did the talk on Mariah Mitchell in science, there were a number of people who gave examples from the 70s and even later of women in the sciences not getting the opportunities or having comments made to them based on gender that would have been made to men.
Do they know how they be discovered during
maybe that's in this book here. That, I mean, obviously Susan B. Anthony has some quotes about her, or the fact that she was at one of these women's conventions. There must have been some things in there. But yeah, there's just this, really the only one I found was this one book that had that. And then, yeah, if you have either the Susan Jacoby or that, the Freedom from Religion Foundation book, there's a couple pages in that book about her and would have probably some references that they drew that from.
Those may be available in our bookcase too.
Yeah, they do have at Sauk City. They have the Freedom from Religion. I think maybe a couple of books because Annie Laurie Gaylor spoke to them some years back. So, but I was just so amazed to find somebody that was like hiding in plain sight, mm-hmm. And then it's so interesting these things she did, like at 17, taking off in the wintertime to go and have a lawsuit against this older man who she didn't want to marry, and then coming up with business ways to support herself. And she was very irrepressible, and she was not bothered by the fact, it was fine with her that these other people she was working with had their beliefs and she had hers, and she didn't try to change theirs, and she was never swayed.
How was your discussion at the Free Congregation of Sauk County?
Oh, I don't remember specifically, but like I said, this one, there is one person there who had, yeah, had done American studies, and I think she taught sociology, so she knew a little bit of, I think she had been doing research on Susan B. Anthony, something like that, where this name came up, but yeah, I don't have any specifics to remember what we discussed.
Other questions for Robin?
Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't bring these other books. Maybe I can send you. I'll send you the those book names.
It's interesting to me to look at her life and how she was a free thinker from very early age and what kind of constitution one has. Because I think lots of people who are free thinkers, they don't seem to have any really much of an influence. They just sort of have that. They look at the world, they look at the facts, and they come to this atheistic conclusion. And I find that fascinating because you assume that, you know, how are my beliefs formed? You assume that I have all these influences and that I come to some conclusion based on all the information. And maybe she was an avid reader, but in Jewish, conservative Jewish household, it wouldn't be a whole lot of divergent thought that she could have consolidated. So that's...
Yeah, right, and you know, the community around her would have been the Jewish community. Her father's the rabbi. Yeah. There was no... I don't think that there would have been discussion about other philosophies.
Yeah. Why not?
But I don't know. Maybe there was because he wanted her to think to learn how to think. But they didn't question the father certainly didn't question the practices and so on. So yes, I don't know. I could have to look into that more to see. But why she took that on when most people stick with the beliefs that are surrounding them, and that she was never swayed by that. Was there some story about Theodore Parker where there's something like that? Like he did something because they said, "Oh, God is he did something to test God," or what was that? And we had it in Sunday school, I think. But
I think you're right, Randy, that there are some people just their way they look at the world is just different than most people.
Yeah. And but you also could take this out. I'm thinking of Greta Thunberg. Now she says that her Asperger's is, you know, allowed her to focus on one thing, and also she doesn't care what people think of her, that she's not stopped, where other teenagers might feel like, oh, you know, I don't want to stand out so much, or get distracted.
She started at 8.
Yes, earlier, that's right. Well, she said, right, when the class moved on to something else, she couldn't move on, and she's right in a way. I mean, right, she's totally logical and right. But it seems that Ernestine was also, you know, very outgoing and entertaining and these things that she says about the Bible, she has this sense of humor. She's using logic. She wasn't doing it to criticize people except in that their actions were causing harm in the world. And yeah, she wasn't necessarily wanting to sway others to her view, but she was just showing them the logic and then bemoaning the bad effects of religion for how women were treated, for how it was sometimes used to justify slavery, things like that.
Well, I can remember when my bicycle disappeared from the school parking lot, and I went home and I prayed about it, you know, and it didn't help. But then I started working, you know, in my room, you know, cleaning up my room, and I looked out like half an hour later and there's my bike in the yard. So, you know, that's where I learned that, you know, work is useful.
Oh.
Claire didn't do it. But my sister, on the other hand, you know, and a lot of Christians would be taught that, well, if your prayer isn't answered, it's because it wasn't supposed to be, you know, that God knows better.
Right.
And that you should just accept whatever is, you know, like if your whole family is killed, that's for the, you know, that's meant to be, and it's for your own good and things like that. That's, I just didn't ever believe, that, you know, I couldn't believe that.
Yeah, yeah, when you see things like a child dying, for instance, that's, to say, oh, this is God's will, they're with God.
But that's what you're taught.
Yeah.
That's what you're taught.
You have a good minister father.
And I mean, for many people, perhaps that is a comfort that there's a plan behind this. It's not just chaotic, or there'll be a reward or something. I was, I'm looking for a book on death for the rest of us, because I was at several Christian funerals recently, and I keep feeling like Christians cheat. Because they say, oh, the person's not really dead. They have an afterlife. You know, they're going to live forever with Jesus, and you can join them there too, instead of dealing with the fact that that this is it. So I don't find it comforting when they take that out, because, you know, other groups, the Jews or the Buddhists and so on, do not have that element. Yeah. Yeah, that's supposed to be comforting. You know, your child is in the arms of God, and it's, well, yeah, is that comforting?
It just pisses me off.
But I mean, I mean, maybe to some people it is, but so it's a question for humanists. And then, because we still hear this thing today about if you don't believe in God, why would you ever do anything good? That's the only reason people do this, because later they might be punished. And so I just saw some little blurb about a church. Somehow their air conditioner was stolen, and they put up a sign that said, keep the air conditioner, you'll need it where you're going.
Oh, there's a sense of humor.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. Do you think Prairie would be interested? Now you've all heard it, so maybe you don't hear it again.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Even though it's not a Unitarian, we're also free thinkers.
It's a fascinating story. It's a fascinating commentary on how people are remembered or not.
Yeah, I mean, this just, I know that, you know, some people, I mean, Margaret Fuller is much less known than Thoreau and Emerson and so on, but within Unitarians, that's how I got started on all this. I went to something, we were up in Minneapolis for Unitarians, and they mentioned her, and I was like, what? I never heard of her. And, and in the general public, she's not known. And neither are most of those other women that I've talked about, but Unitarians have at least heard the name, where this one just was totally absent. And yeah, part of it maybe because she had a somewhat shorter career in the U.S. and went back to Europe and didn't really participate. We don't know what her health issues were. And she didn't have, not having children may not be a problem, because for those who had children, like Julia Ward Howe and some of the others, even their children and relatives tried to, like, pretty them up after they died and tried to make them into more of nice Victorian ladies and downplay their radicalism, so that didn't always help.
Well, it's interesting that of the inheritance thing, because Susan B. Anthony did a lot of that.
And women, this thing about women owning property, and that she took around this petition, which didn't go too well, but it was the wave of the future.
But she was doing it in Europe first, right? That was whether.
Oh, right. Well, that's right. Her inheritance. Yes, she felt that was her inheritance, and she shouldn't have to give it to her husband, or certainly not to a man she didn't even want to marry.
Mm-hmm. So she did that 20, 30 years before Susan B. Anthony.
Right. Yeah. Now, maybe if it had been, I don't know if there was anywhere one there she wanted to marry, but I think she still felt this was hers, and so maybe she would have shared it with someone who respected her, but that wasn't the way it was. She was supposed to get married at 16 to someone older than her and be the wife, and whatever she had went to him, which was the same. We ran into that with, that was Lydia Maria Child, where when her husband proved totally incapable of managing any money, she had to designate another man, a friend of theirs, to be the person to manage her money, because a woman could not...
It's not allowed.
Yeah, could not be in charge of her own finances.
I remember, I was just remembering, in Downton Abbey, you know, where Ward, Mistress Mary or whatever, she had to, marry Matthew because she needed a male heir, because she couldn't inherit the family's wealth, and that was, whenever that was, in terms of...
Well, right, because of the entails in 1912 or whatever, but yes, and it comes clear she's really totally capable of managing everything on the estate. And,
she is, yeah.
But
so I don't know when that happened in England.
Yeah, at some point that did. But
I'm sure it took a lot of women who then got a few male allies to make those things happen.
Yeah, and then somebody gave a talk about this woman who,
I gave a talk once.
Was it,
I can't,
was it about the woman
name,
who, the woman who, yeah, she, that, she about keeping your children when, if you,
yeah, her husband,
got divorced.
The husband was the owner of the children.
Yeah.
And if he wanted to do anything with them, he could.
Yeah, and if you were.
And
yeah.
She helped get the law changed so that a
yeah.
woman could keep the child under her care until he or she was 6 or 7 years old or something. You know, that was a big advance.
Yeah, because they belong to the husband, and so if the wife does leave or feels she must flee because it's dangerous or whatever reason, she gives up the children, even though he may not even really want them.
Right, or be incapable of taking
yeah,
them.
It's property, yeah.
Yeah, and one of her boys died when he was in the care of her husband.
Yeah.
Fell off a pony or something and got hurt.
And what is the, there was a name for that the husband and wife supposedly are one, which is why women didn't need to vote because the man votes for them both. There, but there was some term for what that was called.
I remember reading about like people in the early Protestant church, I'm talking about in America, and they weren't allowed to vote, you know, on church matters.
Oh, right.
In their congregations. But what the women would do is, you know, they, if the man wanted to get up, someone would do this and was going to speak on it in a way that his wife didn't. She'd just hang on to his coat.
No.
Standing up.
Oh.
You know, there are ways.
Yeah.
And that was the point of it. There are ways.
Yeah.
But not the best ways. I mean, the best way is have your own vote.
Yeah.
I love the story of one of the Universalist women in the Civil War who was a doctor. And I'm looking for her name and I can't remember it, but she dressed like a man, which was way more practical, you know, when you were out on the battlefield and stuff. And finally, and of course, she also went to vote. and it was under great pressure to dress like a woman. And finally, Congress gave her, they passed a law that she could wear men's clothing.
Oh my goodness.
To work on the battlefield.
Well,
no, in general.
This was after the Civil War. I think it, because she'd been, you know, very, they were grateful, but yeah, they had to actually pass a law that she could wear men's clothing.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
No, I definitely think you should have.
Oh, okay.